Hello. My name is Stephen Hawking. Physicist, cosmologist, and something of a dreamer. Although I cannot move, and I have to speak through a computer, in my mind, I am free.
Welcome to the Carlite Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlite Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP and a dedicated reader of every issue. With one third of the world's population living in some kind of quarantine, the media is starting to talk about locked-in syndrome. But that's not the locked-in syndrome we're going to cover in this podcast. This locked-in syndrome is one that affected the physicist Stephen Hawking, who gave us the quote at the start of this episode. It is a neurological condition where people are unable to move any part of their body except their eyes, but are fully conscious inside their paralyzed bodies. For Stephen Hawking, the paralysis was the end result of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS. Other times it comes on suddenly, through stroke or trauma to the brain.
It's a terrorizing idea, completely paralyzed but fully conscious, with no hope of recovery. As a medical student, none of the disorders I learned about filled me with such dread as this one. But I was wrong. Most people with locked-in syndrome are satisfied with their lives, and many are happy. Very few, only about 7%, wish for euthanasia. That's the conclusion of every study that has looked at quality of life in locked-in syndrome. We published the latest one in this month's Carlite Report. And even if you never see a patient with locked-in syndrome, these studies have something to teach us, as does the entire body of research on quality of life in people with profound disabilities. They are happier than we think. We're going to talk about those findings today and what they mean for people living with chronic psychiatric disorders. But first, a primer on locked-in syndrome.
Locked-in syndrome is very rare, so rare that review articles are unable to give a prevalence. It's not a disease, but a syndrome, and has many causes. Most typically, it's from injury to the vertical pons through stroke, trauma, or brain tumors. The injury paralyzes every muscle in the body except the eyes, which is the only hope they have of communicating with the world. Blink once for yes and twice for no. Using this Morse code-like language, patients have been able to communicate through a color-coded letterboard. In recent years, those abilities have exploded with computers and robotics. The latest advance is devices that can directly read brainwaves to allow patients who are locked in greater control. Patients who are unable to use their eyes can learn to shift their attention in ways that activate these EEG-based brain-computer interfaces. Recovery is rare, and life is long in locked-in syndrome. If the patient lives past the first few months, they can expect to live for several decades. But few can expect to ever regain control of their muscles. But as we'll see soon, the fact that this syndrome is permanent is part of the reason that quality of life for people who are locked in is better than expected.
Our job as physicians is to understand and empathize with people who are living with illness, both physical and mental. And when it comes to profound disabilities like locked-in syndrome, I was missing the mark. In study after study, people without disabilities consistently estimate that those who have physical disabilities live a very low quality of life, and healthcare workers are even more likely to give those qualities of life a low rating. But when the person with the disability is asked, the result is flipped. People with physical disabilities rate their quality of life just slightly lower than people who don't have disabilities. Paralysis, quadriplegia, loss of limbs, burn injuries, in all of these, the conclusion is the same. We adapt. The same is true for people who are locked together, conjoined twins, and people who are locked inside themselves in locked-in syndrome. The ability to adapt to limitations may be part of this. Quality of life tends to be higher when a disability started earlier in life or has been present from birth. It's also higher when the impairments are stable rather than progressive, like in locked-in syndrome, where the limitations tend to stay the same for years. Happiness tends to increase the longer people live in a locked-in state, which speaks to the ability to adapt. It's the opposite with progressive illnesses that get worse with time, like rheumatoid arthritis and multiple sclerosis. There, well-being goes down as the disease slowly worsens. And here is the paradox. People report a greater quality of life when they believe that their condition is permanent rather than temporary. The most famous study to show this effect looked at people who were put on a colostomy. Some were told that it was permanent, while others were told that it would be temporary. Although both groups lived with the bag for the same amount of time, about 6 months, the ones who believed that it would be permanent were happier about their situation than the ones who were anxiously waiting for the bag to come off. That speaks volumes. How many times do we try to relieve patients by offering up hope that their depression will go away, even when they've lived with it for several decades? In this month's issue, we interviewed Joe Goldberg about how to communicate with people who have chronic, treatment-resistant psychiatric illnesses. Joe calls this pharmacologic futility, and he makes the point that other branches of medicine have embraced a treatment path that realistically suits the needs of those with chronic, untreatable disorders, while psychiatry has been reluctant to accept the reality that many of our disorders are simply not treatable. So back to this paradoxical finding, the one that people are happier when their disorder is permanent than when it's temporary. I think that helps to explain Joe's point of view as well, but his is not a hopeless perspective. Hope is a key ingredient in resilience, and hope is part of what keeps people going in the face of disability. But there's an important distinction to be made there. Hope does not have to be about recovery, or about the next antidepressant working when 12 others have failed. Tune in for more on that in the interview. Joe Goldberg explains how to shift the patient's hope in directions that are more fruitful than the next medication trial. It changed my practice. People with chronic psychiatric illnesses can still live quality lives. Take this 2014 study by Dilip Jesty. He found that nearly half of people with schizophrenia, 38%, said they were happy all or most of the time. And here's a challenging result for those of us who are diligently trying to treat the psychiatric symptoms in schizophrenia. Happiness was not correlated with severity of symptoms, duration of illness, physical health, or cognitive functioning. However, some psychiatric symptoms directly cut down on well-being. Medical illnesses, from cancer to Parkinson's disease, take a more dramatic toll on well-being when they are paired with depression, anxiety, or with certain physical symptoms, most notably pain, but also shortness of breath, which is terrible to live with. Fatigue is actually another one that makes life more miserable when it's paired with medical illnesses. People with locked-in syndrome don't suffer from chronic pain any more than the average person, which also might explain why their quality of life is higher than we'd expect. There's a popular psychological theory that explains a lot of this. It's called hedonic adaptation, and it postulates that we all have a certain happiness set point that we settle back into no matter what slings and arrows of outrageous fortune come our way. We may be able to raise or lower that set point by about 10%, such as through lifestyle changes like exercise, good sleep, or solid friendships. But there's little we can do to shift it beyond that. The classic example of hedonic adaptation is winning the lottery or losing a limb. Immediately following these dramatic events, people are pretty stoked if they won the cash prize, or pretty dejected if they lost a leg. But about 6 months later, their happiness returns to the same level. A lot of research has gone into explaining this unusual finding, and I'll mention one that's illuminating. Lottery winners, and they did study lottery winners here, lottery winners miss out on life's little pleasures. When asked to rate how much pleasure they feel from receiving a compliment, reading a magazine, or hearing a funny joke, they report less pleasure than the rest of us. On the other hand, major traumas can put things in perspective. People who have recently undergone a major medical procedure tend to consider the filling of a dental cavity a relatively minor experience. That nugget of wisdom is true to my own experience practicing psychiatry through three major catastrophes: 9/11, the economic downfall of 2008, and the current coronavirus crisis. Most of my patients actually improved after each of these events, if only temporarily. About 6 months later, they returned to their usual state. I was working at Duke Hospital after 9/11, and they kept the psych clinic open there 24/7 to address the anticipated need for mental health. But not a single person showed up. I imagine instead they went to church. And in the ensuing weeks, my own patients had few complaints after that terrorist attack. They would say things like, "My own problems are nothing compared to what's going on in the world." In 2008, many of my patients lost their jobs, but strangely, they came in with a brighter mood. One man had been in a deep depression that inspired little in the way of motivation, but he came in with a gleam in his eye. "I'm not going to let this beat me down. I've got to fight it and work hard to find an even better job. I'm going to make something out of this." And now I'm seeing a similar pattern with COVID. My anxious and dysthymic patients feel vindicated. "I've been training for this type of thing my whole life," they say, "always worrying about the worst possible outcome, and now it's here. I'm ready." Many are benefiting, at least for now, from the stay-at-home orders and the reduced social and work demands that come with it, not to mention the reduction in commuting time. The ones who are doing particularly well have used this crisis to start a new walking routine, outside, in nature. I've been watching their PHQ depression ratings, and many of my patients are about 10 or 15% better during this viral crisis. But there are a lot of exceptions to this, and we can expect a lot of cases of depression, anxiety, and PTSD to come to our doors in the future.
In Britain, happiness took a sharp dive in the first week of the coronavirus, but it did, on average, return to normal after a few weeks of adjustment. In a survey from Delta Poll done May 2nd, 43% said their general mood was the same as before social isolation began. 23% said their mood was better, and 30% said it had got worse. The stay-at-home order seems to follow the same pattern of adjustment back to the happiness set point that we see with other stressors. But there are a few stressors that stand out as exceptions, and there are the ones to look out for in your patients. People don't recover easily from these setbacks, if they do recover at all. 1. Death of a child or a close family member. It takes 10 to 20 years to recover from the death of a spouse. 2. Chronic progressive illnesses that directly impair well-being, such as through pain, depression, or shortness of breath. 3. Lack of close friendships. And 4. Noise. Although the suffering it causes doesn't compare to the first three, people do not adapt to environmental noise very well. Whether highway noise or aircraft over your house, people seem to get more irritated by noise as time goes on. And that brings us to the word of the day, anosmia.
Anosmia is the loss of the sense of smell, also known as nose blindness. You need to know about this because it's one of the earliest signs of COVID infection. But anosmia was important to mental health long before COVID because this symptom is miserable to live with. People who lose their sense of smell have a greater risk of depression and suicide than people who lose their sense of sight. Who would have thought that the sense of smell would be that important? No one knows exactly why anosmia causes such depression, but here's a hint. The olfactory nerves go right into the hippocampus and amygdala, the centers of emotion and memory in the brain. Each day, the brain stores up memories there and connects them with emotions in ways that give meaning to our lives, and the sense of smell is somehow integral to that. People with anosmia usually don't feel depressed right away. It builds up gradually, and this broken link in identity and emotional experience may be part of the reason. Michael Hutchins, the lead singer of the 80s rock band INXS, developed chronic anosmia after sustaining a traumatic brain injury when he was randomly assaulted in 1992. For Michael, a professed Epicurean, food was one of life's greatest pleasures, and his life was never the same after the accident. Some of the areas of life that concern people with anosmia the most are 1. Danger. Because they are not able to discern the kind of nearby dangers that people detect through the sense of smell, like smoke or a gas leak, or the burning or spoiling of food, they face safety risks. 2. The pleasure of food. Because loss of smell usually implies no sense of taste, cooking and eating loses much of its joy. And 3. Social anxiety. People with anosmia are often anxious around others, in part because they're worried that they may have bad smells or body odors that they can't detect. So when you see a patient who has lost their sense of smell, ask them how it affects their life and do some digging to look for the cause. The causes are many. The most common cause, sinusitis, is fortunately reversible. Other causes include head injury, nasal polyps, and several neurologic disorders.
Join us next week where we'll talk about how to regulate circadian rhythms in bipolar disorder. You can read the full articles and earn CME credits at thecarletreport.com, where we have a special offer for our podcast listeners. You can get $30 off your first year subscription with the promo code PODCAST. And your subscription helps us stay free of industry support. If you like this podcast, share it with someone you know, or give us a rating in the Apple Store. We'd love to hear from you.